wasted enormous amounts of money because we've insisted that grain that we supply has to go on American bottoms, ships, and that this is becomes a subsidy to the American shipping industry. And it costs maybe twice as much to send something to India or to Pakistan on an American ship as it does on a flag of another color. The insistence on buying everything in the United States, you know, in spite of our belief in free trade and competition, we have not. And you can understand politically, the congressman from a state wants to feel that the money that's being spent on foreign aid is being spent in part in his or her district. We had an interesting example in Pakistan. We felt that we had to provide the very best equipment for certain procedures in the family planning process. This is medical equipment. So we brought it all in and we opened up the packages and we discovered that, yes, they came from the United States, but they were made in Pakistan. And Pakistan is so good at producing this particular medical equipment that the best doctors in New York use it. We went through the whole process, you know, shipping this, it being shipped, I should say, in the commercial market to the United States and then being bought in the United States and shipped back to Pakistan as aid. And we could have got it a lot cheaper if we just bought it in from the manufacturers in Pakistan.
But the stipulation was to buy from...
Had to buy it from American suppliers. Another kind of example of the waste of our political system is when we provide wheat to Pakistan, the insistence is that Pakistan cannot export wheat. Well, actually, Pakistan's a big country, and the deficit in wheat in Pakistan is in Karachi, which is a huge city on the, you know, in the desert in the south, on the port city. But there's always a surplus of wheat in the north. Well, the natural market for that is in Afghanistan. Well, in providing wheat to Afghanistan, we've insisted that it had to come from the United States. So we brought wheat into Karachi, shipped it all the way up, you know, 1,000 miles through Pakistan into Afghanistan. From a rational point of view, we should have been providing wheat to Pakistan with the understanding that they would export wheat to Afghanistan from their big producing area. They would have been able to provide a cheaper food source, and we would have saved a lot of money on transportation.
And it generates trade within that region.
And it generates trade within the region. So there are all these anomalies in our own political system, which I think we are hesitant to face up to, which make our program less efficient than it ought to be. I say this, not to be too complaining, but rather to try to give some perspective, recognize that the political process in every country works and does not always work to the greatest efficiency standards that we would like to see applied.
For those of us who are feeling unusually critical about the way things operate in other places,
yeah, we need to have some humility, I think. And that doesn't mean that we don't want to keep pushing on the policy level, as I did, in connection with the fertilizer price relationships in Pakistan. It's just that one needs to understand why good rational policy is not automatically understood, but rather needs to be talked about with a whole lot of people before you convince them to do something. So anyway, after Pakistan, I went back to Washington and had this job as assistant administrator. And then I was invited to be deputy administrator of aid in the last year of the Jimmy Carter period. And I was kept on for a year into the Reagan presidency. And one of the interesting things that happened in the day of the inauguration of President Reagan, at noontime, I became acting administrator because my boss was a political appointee who had to resign automatically as of noontime on the 20th of January. I had, however, been asked to represent the United States at a conference that the Egyptians are holding on Egyptian development in Aswan. So in the morning, there's a 7 hours difference. In the morning, I greeted the meeting on behalf of President Carter. And at 7 o'clock in the evening, the meeting was still going on, I greeted the meeting on behalf of President Reagan. And I had a statement to read from him. And so I was the first spokesperson for President Reagan anywhere in the world, because that happened exactly at 7 o'clock as he was taking the oath of office.
And that was with Sadat there too.
And well, yes, Mr. Sadat had us to tea. And he looked at me and saw my face and said, "You're from the IMF." And he was, and everyone laughed because I wasn't. I was from USAID. But he had got confused about that. And so people had felt that was a good joke on me because he was being very critical of the IMF at that time, but was actually very pleased with what the USAID was doing.
You had the right hat on then.
After a year in the Reagan administration, it was discovered that I was in political circles, that I was a Jimmy Carter appointee, even though I was a career man. I was a Jimmy Carter appointee, and it was time for me to leave. So then I was suggested to the United Nations Environment Program as Deputy Executive Director of the United Nations Environment Program in Nairobi. And I did that for a couple of years, and that was very interesting. We were working on a variety of programs, which later became much more important at the time of the Earth Summit in Rio in 1992. And
what were some of the highlights of those programs?
Well, we had one of the programs that I thought was particularly interesting was what we call the Regional Seas Program. Our interest in UNEP was to bring countries together to on a voluntary basis to develop programs to clean up their regional seas. Now, you can imagine how important this would be in the Mediterranean, which doesn't have much connection with the oceans outside, and with a heavy population density of the area. It was very important. And so we had an office in Geneva, which worked with the countries, and they had meetings every so often in subgroups and so forth, working on various aspects of cleaning up the Mediterranean Sea. Very important for all of the members, but it's all done on a unanimity principle. But it shows you the value of the UN as an intermediary among countries in convening meetings in which they can make positive decisions that improve things. And because during that time, I found myself speaking at an inaugural meeting on the migration of endangered species of birds and animals, and we were developing the program that became the Climate Treaty and the Biological Diversity Treaty, and that's a very interesting things. And it was a very small staff, and almost everything happened because of the leadership of a few countries, including especially the United Kingdom and the United States. So I did that for a couple of years, and then I was invited to be the U.S. candidate to be chairman of the Development Assistance Committee of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Now, at the beginning of this interview, I talked about the OEEC, the European organization that ran the Marshall Plan. At the end of the Marshall Plan period, it was felt that this collaboration that had taken place among the Europeans was so important that it should be continued, but with the United States as a member, and Canada, and Australia, New Zealand, and then eventually Japan, and now a number of other countries, including Mexico and Turkey and so forth. So they developed this OECD, and you may note that every once in a while in the New York Times there's an article about OECD states that such and such is a problem or is happening in the economy of one of the member countries. They have peer reviews, and they take up issues, and they meet at all levels. They go to the Secretary of State and Treasury once a year, but they meet at intermediate levels. And they have committees. There's a committee on agriculture, a committee on education, a committee on economics, and so forth. And one of the committees that we urged them to develop was the Development Assistance Committee, because we wanted the Europeans to participate in the financial load of helping developing countries. And so we did that, and we provided the chairman for the first 25 years of this group. And so I was provided by the United States, seconded, so to speak, from the United States, but elected once a year for 5 years. And we had meetings every 2 weeks, and we had a review of the French program or the Danish program or the American program. And then we would have meetings on subjects. The United States is very much interested in getting others to be more interested in the status of women and the role of women in development. So we had a little subgroup working on the role of women in development, and we had another one working on environment, because we had another group on statistics, because we compared our statistics to make sure that we were, you know, being honest in our and accurate in our reporting of the effort we were making in economic development. So we met on the average of every 2 weeks. It was a full-time chairman job, and once a year I issued a report. And actually, this is sort of the it's a job from a bureaucratic point of view. It's the top job in the development business in the world. From a policy point of view, obviously, the World Bank presidency is more important, and the IMF head is more important. But the DAC chairman has this unique role of chairing the bilateral donors with the World Bank and UNDP sitting in. So that was a very interesting experience for me.
We got to live in Paris for 5 years.
Yes, we did. And
you did what? I didn't hear that.
Oh, my wife said, and we lived in Paris for 5 years. which, you know, after many years in Pakistan and a couple of years in Kenya with the United Nations Environment Program and so forth, it was sort of fun to live in Paris for a while. And then the last regular job I had in my career was I was invited to be sort of the number three person in the in the little staff in Geneva that was preparing for the Rio Earth Summit that took place in 1992. So in 1991 and in early 92, we were in Geneva. And in that meeting, there was a process of negotiation of policies in all kinds of areas, from oceans to agriculture to handling of chemicals, and population health, education, and so forth. So we had chapters of a document called Agenda 21 for the 21st century. And and so I was the coordinator for this document. And we had, you know, about 20 staff members working on it. And then there were groups all over the world meeting and developing these chapters, and they had to follow my format. And then, of course, we went to the Earth Summit itself, and I was sort of the secretary for the finance committee, and my wife worked on the non-governmental organizations as a volunteer, and we watched President Bush signed the climate treaty, the first President Bush. Unfortunately, later on, the protocol that was developed out of that, the Kyoto Protocol, was not signed by the United States. That was a disappointment for us, but